Women have always been partners on the farm, but they haven't always been equal partners. This hour, women's voices in agriculture through history and today. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. My first guest today has studied the roles of women in leadership on the farm. Jenny Barker Devine is the author of On Behalf of the Family Farm, Iowa Farm Women's Activism Since 1945. We'll also talk about women in agriculture today with Chris Henning, a fourth-generation farmer from Greene County, Angie Carter of the Women, Food, and Agriculture Network, and Ellen Walsh Roseman, an organic farmer from Harlan. Join our conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. When we think about feminism, most of us don't immediately think of rural Iowa. But rural Iowa has always been home to strong women, and many of those women have worked side by side with men on farms. This hour, we'll talk about women's voices in agriculture through history and today. Later in the hour, I'll talk with Jenny Barker Devine. She is the author of On Behalf of the Family Farm, Iowa Farm Women's Activism Since 1945. She's also an assistant professor of history at Illinois College. But first, I'm going to talk with Chris Henning. She is a fourth-generation farmer from Greene County. Hello, Chris.
Hello, Charity.
Thank you so much for being here today.
And
can you give me a little bit of your background? Because you left the farm and didn't think that you would look back.
That's right. I left after high school long ago and planned on never being back on the farm again.
So what in growing up on the farm, what made you think this is nothing that I want to commit my life to?
I don't know that it was farming so much as the thought that being away from a very small town and a rural community and farming was not what I was going to spend my life at. And I really had plans on being either a teacher or a journalist. And I didn't think I could do either one of those from the farm.
And you did have a career as a journalist. What brought you back to the farm?
Actually, I wasn't a journalist. I had a career at Meredith Corp, but it was more in personnel and labor relations and that kind of thing. What brought me back to the farm? Well, I would come home and see my parents, and my kids got to grow up summers on the farm with my mom and dad. And it was like, ooh, I just don't like this city living. I want to be back out in the country. And so I was fortunate enough after 25 years in Des Moines to move to find a farm close to where I grew up. And I traded my house in Des Moines for a house in the country that needed a lot of work and a farm.
A lot of people who feel nostalgic for rural living buy themselves an acreage and continue to work in town. What was it that made you actually want to get back into the business of farming?
Well, I had grown up on a farm where my dad always crop shared or farmed it himself. And as he got ready to retire, then he crop shared. He had a guy who helped him do the work or did the work, and he stayed very, very, very active in the marketing and the managing and making the decisions. And so he was a really good model for how to do that, and I thought I could have the best of both worlds and kind of think I have. I don't actually do most of the operating myself. I have a tenant who does a phenomenal job of that part of it. But we make decisions together about what will be planted and where it will be, how it will be rotated and what we're going to try new and that kind of thing.
When you think back, since we're spending this hour talking primarily about women and their voices on the farm, when you think back watching your parents farm together, watching your grandparents farm together, how would you characterize those partnerships?
I would say that they were equal partnerships. While my mother took care of most of the house things, she did that with my help. I was the oldest of the six of us sisters. And that left her time to take care of the pigs, the chickens, drive the tractor. And as we got old enough, even the daughters became farmers. I learned to drive a tractor when I was 10, probably is why I can still drive a stick shift today. That kind of thing. My grandparents on both sides were farmers, and the women were strong into helping with the day-to-day operations of the farm and the day-to-day operations of keeping big families going.
Do you think they would have referred to themselves as farmers?
My mother did.
Yeah?
I don't think I ever thought about it when my grandparents were busy actually doing it. I was the oldest grandchild on both sides, and I just watched it. My grandmother had the biggest garden and was known to cook 14 pies for before 6 o'clock in the morning. I still don't know how she did all of that. But
do you think with so many other women of the time, it sounds unusual that your mother would have been so involved in the day-to-day work of farming and even referred to herself as a farmer? A lot of women who did all of that work never called themselves farmers. Do you think that that was a conscious decision that your mother made?
Oh, I'm sure it was. She was. She taught school before she married my dad. She was a conservationist as much as he was, knowing her favorite subject to teach was geography and basically what we call conservation now. She knew all of the plants. She knew the landforms. She knew about erosion, talked about it, and so did my dad.
You also focus a great deal on conservation on your land. Can you tell me a little bit about your land and your farming practice?
Well, on my original farm, my 145 acres, has three creeks, and a lot. We're only a mile from the Raccoon River, and so it has a lot of hilly ground and wetlands, as just being upland from the river. So, after the flood of 93, that would have been my second year on the farm, and the flood of 93 started in Jefferson with 8 inches of rain some July day. I can't remember exactly, the 10th or 11th or something of July. And I watched as that pig in the python kind of thing, where we had 8 inches of rain. The next day, Adele was underwater. The third day, Des Moines was underwater from all of the runoff from the Raccoon River. And so I got interested in keeping my land and my chemicals and my seed out of the Des Moines water source, the Raccoon River, and have buffers along those creeks and wetlands later and prairie plantings on the highly erodible ground, just to keep the farm where it sits and not down in either in Des Moines or either further down the river at that Gulf dead zone.
Just last week, we were hearing news reports about very high levels of nitrogen in and other farm chemicals in the Raccoon River. When you hear stuff like that and you think about the work that you're doing and maybe other farms where you don't see those kind of precautions being taken, what do you think about?
People make choices, and to get the highest yields, you need nitrogen and phosphorus, and putting the ammonia on or the manure to fertilize. It's like a balancing act, And the yields for corn take high values of both nitrogen and phosphorus. And so it's, again, it's a balancing act. And cover crops and some of the old ways of rotating from alfalfa and oats and then corn and then soybeans and back into alfalfa and oats, or putting a cover crop on your crop, are coming back into favor just to keep some of those chemicals, our farm chemicals, out of the tile lines. Pattern tiling has been, you know, if you're going to try to get a big crop, you don't want too much water in your soil and you don't want too much runoff. So you have to balance it all.
We seem to hear, when we talk to groups that are focused more on sustainable agriculture, we seem to hear a lot more voices of women in those groups than we do from the more traditional farming groups. Do you think that there is something about women in agriculture that leads them to have a stronger connection to conservation?
Not to say that men don't care about conservation. My work most recently has been with Women, Food, and Agricultural Network. And with almost half of the farmland now being either owned or controlled by women in Iowa, I tend to think that women think more about conservation. But that's because we're trying to teach them about it. And so I have lots of friends, men friends, who are in farming. Of course, the operators tend to be largely men. And it would be unfair to say that they didn't care about conservation. It's just that I more often hear the woman's voice.
Interesting. And there, of course, have been many more women getting into agriculture, and specifically into smaller-scale agriculture. Do you see women as a very important part of agricultural future in Iowa?
I think so. The smaller, sometimes the USDA calls us hobby farmers or sustainable ag units, where we are doing fruits and vegetables. Now, that isn't to say that in California, not Iowa, but in California, vegetable farms are very, very, very large, probably like our corn farms are here. But the farms that we see here, like the Tabletop CSA over at Nevada, and some of the other, the One Step at a Time Gardens up at up near Mason City and Clear Lake. Anyway, those are smaller operations, but they're very intense and very conservation and very sustainable, either organic or very, very, very low chemical. Even Laura Krause over there by Mount Vernon.
Well, Chris, I'm so sorry to cut you off, but we are out of time for this segment. We're going to take a short break and talk more about the history of women on farms. Chris Henning is a fourth-generation farmer from Greene County. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're talking about women's voices in agriculture. We were just listening to Chris Henning, who is a fourth-generation farmer from Greene County, a voice of a woman in agriculture today. But now we're going to go back through time. Jenny Barker Devine is the author of On Behalf of the Family Farm, Iowa Farm Women's Activism Since 1945. She's also an assistant professor of history at Illinois College. Hello, Jenny.
Hello.
Thank you for being here today. And let's go back in time, and let's go back before 1945. As I mentioned earlier in the hour, women, of course, have been working with men on the farm since there have been farms, but they were mostly considered to be in supporting roles, whatever the reality might have been. But they also had supporting roles in farming organizations, right? So let's talk about what some of their roles were like before 1945.
Sure. Yeah, that's right. So women have always been involved in agricultural organizations, typically in these sort of supportive roles. So if something needed to be done, if something needed to be set up, or you needed, baking, cooking done for something, they would do that. But, you can also see them doing some more overtly political things. So like membership drives, getting people involved with the organization. You know, they were in charge of going out and often finding new members. And male leaders, they recognized this. And there was one president of the Farm Bureau who said, you know, get the women if you want to hold the men, you know, with the idea that wives would talk their husbands into joining the group. So, you know, they had played a whole variety of roles, everything from, you know, making sure that the drinks were on the table to making sure there were members in the organization. And really kind of keeping things afloat at the local levels as well.
But they did not hold leadership roles in the organization.
No, not really. Now, Iowa was unique, though, in that right away, the Farm Bureau was founded in 1919, and right away, women were interested in getting involved. And the first woman who really wanted to see women organize on a large scale made sure that the Iowa Farm Bureau Women's Committee was not an auxiliary to the main organization. She wanted it to be part of you know, the main office and just sort of another office within the organization. So she didn't want to be seen as subservient in any way. And then Ruth Sayer, who took over for her in the 1930s, pushed that even further by demanding a budget, which in the history of farm women's organizations, getting that budget really is key to empowering women and getting money to do activities and that type of thing.
What kinds of activities are we talking about?
You know, most women belong to homemakers clubs, and so that meant they would get together usually once a month at a woman's house. They would sort of go around the neighborhood and take turns hosting. They'd usually have some type of lesson. Sometimes that would be from a, you know, home demonstration agent or an extension agent. They might teach them about how to make your own dress form or how to, you know, can better, like a new technique in canning. So when pressure cookers came out, that would have been a lesson they might have had. How to better economize, how to make better clothes for your kids, this type of thing, nutrition, whatever it is. So they'd have that lesson, and then they would usually do something social. So they might each have to bring a sweet treat to eat or something like that. And so in that way, they were sort of, you know, learning new skills. It was really adult education. But you also see them doing other things, you know, learning about issues. So learning about education. If they don't like the schools in their neighborhood, how can they improve those? How can they get a library? How can they get a health clinic? So they also learn about those things. And in a lot of cases, you see the women following through, applying for the funding or doing a fundraiser and then getting those resources for their community. So even though they're just meeting in a home and having some type of lesson, a lot of times that actually translated into some type of local action that they could take.
You focus on the years after 1945. What made 1945 a watershed year in your mind? What changed?
Well, you know, after 45, things are so different. You know, the Second World War is over. And things are changing, and the government is getting more involved in agriculture with subsidies and price supports, and farmers are very concerned about that. But also the technology is changing, what they can produce and how they can produce it. And really what you see is over time, and this isn't an instant change, but over time, if you want to farm, there's paperwork to be done. You know, you have to not just interact with your local implement dealer or the local grain elevator, but now you're really working with, you know, people from the USDA and other programs, and it's becoming more of a business. And you have to interact with a whole variety of people, many of whom you don't know or you've never met. You know, they're just sort of people on the other end of this paperwork. And, you know, women see that, and they can't just be active in their neighborhoods anymore. You know, if they disagree with the policy, then they have to be sure that they're talking to legislators and policymakers. So it changes the game for them a little bit.
It strikes me that there is a bit of a splintering among farmers as well and farm organizations, because before 1945, really, the Farm Bureau was the only game in town. After that, we start to see the National Farmers Union, the Iowa Farmers Union. Tell me about the Farmers Union.
Okay, so the Farmers Union had been around. In fact, it predated the Farm Bureau just a little bit, by about 2 years. But they never quite had the same hold on Iowa that they had on other states. They were predominantly a Western organization in the Dakotas and Colorado, Wyoming. They also had a big presence in Minnesota and Wisconsin. But for some reason, Iowans just didn't join in the big numbers. They tended to, embrace a little bit more liberal agenda. They tended to use a rhetoric that came more from the labor unions than the Farm Bureau did. And I think for some people that was really appealing. They really liked to think of, you know, farmers as a social class, and other people didn't quite so much. So, by the 50s, what makes the Farmers Union in Iowa so interesting is that they start to come under fire from both the federal government and the National Farmers Union for almost being, you know, too far to the left. And that controversy really sort of gets a lot of members concerned about their future. Basically, what happened was the president at the time, Fred Stover, was a pacifist, and he was against the Korean War. And because he spoke out against the war, they tried to remove him from the presidency. They couldn't do that, so they basically just shut down the Farmers Union in Iowa for a few years and then brought it back by the end of the 50s under new leadership.
There seems to be an emphasis on women getting their husbands to sign up for these groups, and an idea that women are the ones that perhaps control whether or not the man in their life is politically active.
Oh, sure. I mean, you know, the dues cost money, you know, to join the National Farmers Organization, for example, and that was a little bit different because it was more like a cooperative, so it was a bit more expensive. But in the 50s, that would have been $25 a year, which for some farm families would have been tremendously expensive. You know, if you want to send your kids to school and have a radio and some other nice things, you know, do you want to spend that money? And a lot of times, if women were the ones raising chickens and selling eggs and this type of thing, they were actually the ones with the cash. And they could have that sway of, well, no, I don't think we want to spend our money on this. Maybe we'd rather go in a different direction. So there were a lot of instances where women were sort of the ones to say, you know, I think we should join, or, well, maybe not this year because we need this money for something else.
Tell me about the Porkettes. That was a group that was entirely made up of women in Iowa.
Yes, that was one of my favorite groups to study. They were just so much fun. So the Porkettes started out as the auxiliary to the Iowa Pork Producers. And there was also a National Porkettes, and then there were other states with the Porkettes. But Iowa, you know, they were really intense. They always kept that Porkette name. So they started in 1964 as, I believe, as an auxiliary to the Iowa Pork Producers. But by the mid-70s, there's this really interesting shift, almost away from working with the men and working as an auxiliary. They are starting to demand a lot more attention, a lot more authority. And I've seen some correspondence between the two groups where, you know, the Iowa Pork Producers were supposed to be giving the women a subsidy, and they didn't always get it on time. And that really hindered their ability to do a lot of things. And so eventually in 1976, they just broke away and decided to become their own organization. They were still associated with the pork producers. So what they did was go out and promote pork. You know, they were the ones sort of before this whole idea of the other white meat and these big ad campaigns. They were the ones proving that perhaps this commodity-based promotion could work. And, you know, they saved the organization thousands and thousands of dollars by using volunteer labor to promote these products. And basically convinced the pork producers that spending the money on advertising was really worthwhile. But at the same time, they're also, you know, going in and promoting themselves as pork producers. And so you see within the Iowa Pork Producers, they used to recognize the Iowa Pork Producer of the Year. By the early 80s, however, they're recognizing the pork producing family of the year, to recognize the husband and the wife and everybody who's involved. So, you know, they're really sort of making these efforts to include themselves at all phases of production.
Now, of course, in the 1970s, there were a lot of women who were moving out of their traditional roles in the kitchen, in the home, and going to work, a big feminism movement. And that's not something that a lot of us associate with rural Iowa. As these groups developed and changed over the years, as women's roles in society changed over the years, would you have considered these groups to be feminist?
You know, in a lot of ways, I do. I call it a sort of agrarian feminism because it's not necessarily what you expect. You know, we usually expect to see feminism in the 70s as, you know, going out sort of like the Mary Tyler Moore Show or something and being independent and, you know, maybe these marches or these radical actions. And in fact, the New York Times in the 1970s published these articles about how there's no feminism in the countryside. You know, they'd go out and they'd interview these women, like members of the Porquettes, who would say, oh, no, 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 I'm not a feminist at all. But when you look at what they're doing, they really are challenging the way society has defined their roles. They're challenging what it is that women should do. They might not be challenging it in the same way, though. And so I think for this reason, a lot of people have discounted rural women in the feminist movement. But when you really think about what their needs were, they might not necessarily challenge sexism maybe within their own lives, but if they need to put a crop in the ground, or if they need to sell the pork, or if they need to do something that's integral to their farm operation, then they need to go out and they need to challenge, you know, those policies and things that they believe have discriminated against them. And the other thing is, going out to work and being independent isn't necessarily what farming is about. You know, it's really about working with a family and being dependent on one another. It's about living in a community and sustaining that community. So farm women have a whole different set of needs than maybe what we think of in the traditional sense of this 1970s second wave feminism. They absolutely depend on men for resources and access to the land and that type of thing. So they're not necessarily going to look for independence, but they are going to seek out policies and changes that allows their farm to be successful, and for them to be able to do whatever it is that they want to do.
And they're not going to call that feminism.
Exactly.
So let's talk about today. In just a moment, we're going to have another farmer join the show to talk about the work that she's doing today, and another representative of the Women Food and Agriculture Network. But when you look around you today, what do you see in agriculture today that has grown out of the work of these women in the 1970s?
You know, they seem to recognize that women did, in fact, play an important role in agriculture, and that they had a particular way of looking at agriculture as a community activity, as something that was very important, not just to, society as a whole, you know, feeding the world. But, you know, their idea is, we want to create a business, we want to create a farm that we can hand down to our children. And now I think you look at these, you know, women who own half the land in Iowa, who are saying, you know, I want to not just pull in a big crop this year or make a big profit, but I want to be sure that this land is around for other people to use, for my children to use, for my family to use. And you hope then that that's going to translate into better policies about sustainability and, help us rethink, you know, what our priorities really are.
We still don't necessarily hear a lot of women's voices in making those agricultural policies, though.
That's right. And I do think that's changing. There's a lot of young women now that are not just farming. Now I hear more and more about dads who look around at their families, and maybe the sons don't have any interest in farming, and they say, well, I never thought that my daughter might want to farm. And so now you see these younger women who are inheriting and taking over the family business. And you also see a lot more younger women getting degrees at the college level, getting master's degrees and graduate degrees, who I think will move on into making more policy. And I don't know that it's going to be in the next year or 5 years even, but down the road, we're going to be hearing more and more voices from women. I believe that.
I'm talking with Jenny Barker Devine. She is an assistant professor of history at Illinois College, and she is the author of the book On Behalf of the Family Farm, Iowa Farm Women's Activism Since 1945. And we're going to focus more on the present in a moment. I'll talk with a second-generation farmer in Iowa who runs an organic farm in Harlan. We'll also talk with a member of the Women Food and Agriculture Network, who is getting her PhD at Iowa State University. And we'd love to hear from you as well, your thoughts on women in agriculture, your memories of your mother or your grandmother taking a leadership role on the farm or even in policy. 866-780-9100 is the number to call. 866-780-9100. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. We're talking about women's voices in agriculture through history and today, this hour. With me is Jenny Barker Devine. She's the author of the new book, On Behalf of the Family Farm, Iowa Farm Women's Activism Since 1945. And now I want to bring another farmer into the conversation. Ellen Walsh Roseman is a second-generation farmer. She and her husband have an organic farm near Harlan. Hello, Ellen.
Hello, thank you for having me.
Well, thank you so much for being here today. And tell me a little bit about your operation.
Sure. My husband and I farm with his family. The whole farm is 700 acres, all certified organic. And I run the vegetable enterprise and a new egg enterprise.
And how long have you and your husband been involved with the family farm?
This is our third year farming together. And Daniel has been farming with his family since he got out of college.
Is farming something that you've wanted to do for a long time, or is this a fairly new interest of yours?
I've wanted to be a farmer since I was in third grade. I remember the moment when I declared that. I grew up on a dairy goat farm, and my parents sold the dairy goats when I was in second grade. And we still lived on the farm and then on the acreage. And I always helped my uncles at their dairy farms and worked at a dairy farm when I was in high school and was very active in FFA when I was in high school and decided that I couldn't live without agriculture. So I decided to go to Iowa State and study agriculture.
When you were in FFA and you had declared that you wanted to become a farmer, did anybody give you any pushback about the fact that you were a girl who wanted to become a farmer?
I think maybe I had a little of that, but I've always been kind of an independent girl and woman, so always kind of wanted to be like the boys and didn't really care what people thought about my gender role.
So you mentioned you're in charge of the vegetable operation. Describe it for me.
Okay, this is our third year of vegetables, and I decided when I moved to the farm, to rural Harlan, that after going to the grocery store when I first moved there in the end of August, that these folks need vegetables because everything was coming from California. It was all wrapped in plastic, and I was disappointed that people weren't experiencing vegetables that I was used to. So I decided, with a lot of resistance, to start a CSA.
So a community-supported agriculture program, so people buy shares in what you're producing.
Correct. Mm-hmm. And so my first year, I really focused heavily on feeding my community, and I'm still doing that today. The vegetable operation is 2.5 acres of vegetables, and I have a lot of people that buy vegetables from me, and believe it or not, some of them are actually farmers as well, but they grow things that they, like corn and soybeans, so they can't eat their food.
So you are involved in a lot of different organizations, in Practical Farmers of Iowa. You're involved in a growers network, Lone Tree Foods. You're on the board of the Iowa Food Systems Council. You're also part of the Women Food and Agriculture Network. Why is it important to you to be so politically active, or so active in these organizations?
Sure. When I decided that Daniel and I were going to get married, I figured I can make change as a farmer in Iowa, where things are happening. I don't need to go to Washington, D.C. to do policy changes. So I've put myself in these positions and decided this is the best way to be active and politically active, and also educate people about their food and hopefully change the food system in rural Iowa.
Is it time-consuming? I mean, being a farmer is incredibly time-consuming.
Yeah, I'm probably spreading myself a little thin, but I enjoy it, and it's something that I think needs to be done, and life is short.
I want to bring Angie Carter into the conversation as well. She's a PhD student at Iowa State University studying sustainable agriculture and sociology, and she also sits on the board of the Women Food and Agriculture Network. Hello, Angie.
Hi, Charity. Thanks for having me on.
Tell me why it's important for you as a PhD student. Why is it important for you to be involved in the Women Food and Agriculture Network?
Well, I was lucky enough to be invited to apply for the board as a student member when I first moved back to Iowa in 2010. And it's really been a framework for all of the research and much of my engagement in Iowa organizations since. I've met so many women who are change makers in their community, like Ellen shared and Chris shared, who really have this ethic of seeing agriculture as a community activity, as Jenny described. And I think that that's really important as an entryway to thinking about not just local level changes, but national and global level changes in creating a healthier food system.
Now, Ellen, I'd like to get your input on this as well, and Jenny as well. But Angie, as you look at the women who are involved with the Women Food and Agriculture Network, you look at other organizations, do you see more and more women getting involved politically in policymaking and farming?
Yes, we are seeing more of that. And actually, the Women Food and Ag Network was one of the founding partners of Plate to Politics, which is a national initiative to try to harness some of this energy that Ellen and others are doing at the local level to create more positions for women in leadership in farm organizations nationally, but also in politics.
And Ellen, does it feel like you're part of a movement that there are more and more women getting involved in this way?
I would say so. I'm a young farmer, so I haven't been able to observe the movement that long, but I would say that there are a lot of women that are becoming more politically active with policy.
When you are participating in these groups, obviously not the Women Food and Agriculture Network, but you're involved in so many different groups, Ellen, are men as present as women?
I don't know. I feel like I'm a little polarized in the work that I do. Maybe there's a lot more women sitting at the table, but if you look at other leadership roles in the ag and food system, not many women are taking roles or are having roles in co-op boards or conservation districts or those kinds of things. So, like I said, I'm a little polarized. I think there's a lot in the circle that I run in.
Well, sure. In the circle that you run in, I mean, we're talking about the local foods movement. We're talking about organic farming and small-scale agriculture, a different kind of agriculture that is growing in Iowa right now, although it doesn't represent the majority by any means. Do you think that there's a division between the kind of farming that you're involved in and the kind of farming that has more traditionally been in the state, and also men and women? Do you think that women who are in farming tend to be more involved in the kind of farming that you're doing?
It's hard for me to say, but I want to say that yes, women are seem to be more sustainably minded and more thinking about food and growing food for their family and then also their community. But I also don't want to be us versus them. And I think everyone should be involved at the whole food, at the table, men, women, young, old, conventional, alternative, organic farmers, non-farmers, small farmers. That's all going to benefit the food system.
Angie, can you weigh in on that?
Sure. I'm a sociology PhD student, and you know, I'm interested in studying gender in agriculture, and I think that, you know, traditionally women have been more connected to thinking about public health or food health because they are the ones who traditionally have been growing the food and buying the food at the store and making the food for their families. And so perhaps that has positioned them to be more advocate on this issue more. But I think that that's something that is not specific only to women. And by bringing this community ethic to agriculture, women like Ellen and others are making the agricultural system more inclusive for all different types of people and all different types of visions.
And Jenny, do you have a perspective you'd like to share on this?
Yeah, you know, I was thinking about, you know, the Women, Food, and Agriculture Network has been doing some phenomenal work the last several years, basically just listening to farm women and women landowners and the things that they care about. And what you find is that they also did some surveys as part of a larger project, that a lot of these women, even if they do have, you know, a large conventional farm that they own, maybe they don't do the work themselves, they have a tenant or something, they do not necessarily feel comfortable going to these meetings with men in these sort of mainstream organizations. Or they don't necessarily feel comfortable walking into the implement dealer and negotiating a price on a piece of equipment. And they've also done surveys that show, you know, men in positions of authority in agribusiness and this type of thing don't always take the women seriously. There were indications that, you know, even extension agents admitted to, well, when I approach this, you know, older female landowner, she seems emotional or she just doesn't seem like she knows what she's doing. And so one thing that the Women, Food, and Agriculture Network has been doing is trying to figure out, okay, what types of information do these women want? What do they need? And what works best for them? And so, sort of, you know, getting them the information in the way that they need it and the way that they want it. And usually what they find is, you know, just like 100 years ago, they still prefer all female groups. And so that's kind of an exciting development, I think.
Do you think that that is a limitation, though?
Well, I think it's a necessary part of the process. You know, as we, you know, continue to educate, you know, everyone about the roles that women play in agriculture, then we can begin to recognize this. I mean, when you think about it, the, you know, USDA didn't even count more than one farm operator until the 1990s, and they really didn't even think about female landowners. So when you think about who they were making the policies for, women didn't even enter into the equation, and this is just, you know, in our lifetime here. And now that they're counting, you know, women as farm operators, even if their husband primarily owns the farm and everything, they are still counted now in the agricultural census as being part of that farming operation. So I think this is going to be a long, drawn-out process for us as we continue to think about these issues.
Ellen, when you talk to farmers who have been farming for much longer than you, and of course with your husband's family, there are probably farmers that you're very close to that go back a long time. Do you discuss how things have changed for women on the farm?
Usually the discussion is about what crops they have in and what the weather's like and how the fields are looking. It's you don't really talk about those fluffy things.
So do you have any observations, though, looking at family dynamics that you can see how there have been some changes?
Yeah, I think that the roles of women on the farm are changing. They're becoming more involved with major decisions. They're no longer farm wives, they're farmers. When I first moved to my community and I would introduce myself, as a farmer, people would correct me and say, oh, you mean you're a farm wife. And yes, I am married to a farmer, but I am also a farmer.
That's interesting. I mean, you talked about not necessarily getting resistance when you were in the FFA, but it sounds like you still get a little bit of that gender stereotyping in your career today.
Yeah, and I think that really motivates me more and to prove myself and to keep doing what I can do. I think it's lots of farmers, you know, can quote a number of how many people they're feeding, and I can quote that as well, but I also know the people that I'm feeding. So I feel like I'm proving myself that way.
Angie, being in school and being around other women who are at this point in their lives, who are studying agriculture, not necessarily engaged in agricultural practices yet, but when you talk to other women in your cohort, do you find attitudes changing about ag?
I think that there are generational changes, and we see it a lot. Those of us who are in my program, we're mostly in our 20s and 30s. There are some women who have come back to the program after having had farms and had careers. And it's really an exciting time to be asking questions about agriculture and trying to revision the system because, I mean, we start talking about how are women involved in agriculture, but really the question is who's controlling the decisions and who's in power and why are there not more diverse voices in agriculture? And so we're really looking at that together. But I've seen in my work with older women landowners in Iowa that many of them do share that, you know, they see such a transformation from their generation when they were told they couldn't be part of FFA, for example. And they're bringing their daughters, they're bringing their granddaughters to these meetings that the Women, Food, and Ag Network is hosting so that they can have access to these resources and know that there's this community there.
And Jenny, when you look at the history of women and their voices and their activism, their roles in farming organizations through time, what lessons do you think we can take from the past to apply to today's agricultural world?
You know, I think the biggest thing is just that women have always, at least in the 20th century, the era that I've studied, always had an interest in agriculture. And so to discount women's voices is, you know, really counterproductive because they have been there, they have done the work, and they have been very, very proud of their contributions. And so, you know, in a lot of ways, they've really done a lot of the work that had to be done. They didn't necessarily get the public accolades for it, but they've always been there.
Jenny,
and
thank
you. Not going away.
Jenny, thank you so much.
Thank you so much. I enjoyed this.
Jenny Barker Devine is the author of On Behalf of the Family Farm, Iowa Farm Women's Activism Since 1945. Ellen Walsh Roseman, thank you so much.
Thank you for having me.
Ellen Walsh Roseman is a second-generation farmer. She and her husband have an organic farm near Harlan. And also, thank you very much, Angie Carter.
Thank you, Charity.
Angie Carter is a PhD student at Iowa State University. She also sits on the board of the Women, Food, and Agriculture Network. Talk of Iowa is produced by Sarah Bowden, Dennis Reese, Emily Woodbury, and Ben Stanton. Our executive producer is Catherine Perkins. Technical support today from Alyssa Weiss in Ames. You can send us email anytime. Our email address is talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. We'd like to hear your thoughts about things you've heard on the show. We'd like to hear your suggestions for things you'd like to hear on the show in the future. Again, talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Our theme music was composed and performed by the River Monks. I'm Charity Nebbe. Tomorrow on the show, wildlife biologist Jim Pease. Talk of Iowa is a production of Iowa Public Radio News.